for New Year's resolutions you want to make, than about biases in the sense of discrimination. And at the end, if we've got time, I also have three quick points about the science of carrying through on New Year's resolutions. And to give you a sense of kind of the broader picture that I'm thinking in, let me tell you about my car. I've got this wonderful 1993 Volvo. It's literally called a classic. It has that on the back because it's the last year they made the 240 series that succeeded the 140 series. I've owned 140s or 240s for over half my life. When I was younger, I used to do a lot of my own work and rebuild them. I know them in and out. I can be going down the road and hear a little noise from the back of the car and think, sounds like maybe the fuel pumps can need to be changed out. I can open up the hood and you can actually see an engine and ground on the other side of it. Doesn't look like you just opened the back of a robot. And I got one that it might well have been owned by a little old lady who only drove it on Sundays. It has relatively low mileage, though it's at the point in its life where things are starting to go out and I either need to let them break or be proactive and like replace the top 10 things that are most likely to go out, you know, which I can do. And theoretically, then the car should be good for another 100,000 miles. Except I realize the problem I'm having is just it's an old car, and it's not like I bought the car with this amount of mileage in it in the year 2000 and replaced the parts. It's almost 20 years older than that. And I can replace the ignition control module, but the wiring and the connector that goes to that may just start to disintegrate. So I'm at this point where I've got to decide, you know, is it worth continuing to spend money on this car, or is it time to say enough is enough? And that is exemplary of one of my favorite cognitive biases, which is known as sunk costs, or epitomized by the old saying about throwing good money after bad, which is one of the things we're prone to doing as human beings, is to continue investing, whether it's in money or mentally or otherwise, in things that we already have an investment in without necessarily stopping to consider whether it makes sense to continue investing in that thing or doing something different. So what I want to talk about in particular are these cognitive biases that we're prone to. The formal definition of them is they're a systemic error in thinking that affects the decisions and judgments that people make. I like to look at them from the viewpoint of evolutionary psychologists, that they're actually innate, inherent, involved mechanisms that did a great job of solving what were often survival problems when human beings were evolving in small hunter-gatherer groups, and don't necessarily do us so well in modern societies where we grow to 2-3 times the age that our earliest forebears lived, and so on. To be clear, cognitive biases relate to logical fallacies, and some of them are actually the same. Sunk costs is sometimes called a logical fallacy. In general, a logical fallacy is just a simpler piece of logic, like, for instance, the well-known one of false cause, in which, for instance, you know, someone might assert in an argument, because X, then Y, and you would point out, you know, those things really aren't connected. But it's also a cognitive bias because we're prone to seeing things that way, making meaning out of things. You know, our primitive ancestors saw the sunrise and the sun go down and disappear, and, you know, decided that some god must be doing that and driving things across the sky in a chariot. And in that way, I feel that cognitive biases get to the bigger picture and to larger issues of philosophy, spirituality, and religion. It addresses the issue of why we're prone to doing things that are not necessarily good for ourselves, others, or the world around us. Many parts of what in traditional religion might be called sin. And I like looking at these things because I think it's one of the cases where analysis and science can allow us to understand things in a way that illuminates the larger issues that we deal with as human beings that are wonderful and mysterious and maybe even spiritual. So to talk a bit more about the specifics of cognitive biases, there are generally about 3 to 4 dozen of them that are most commonly cited as affecting people, and somewhere around a total of 200 that have been categorized. And I obviously can't address all of those today. They're actually typically grouped into 4 groups that I'm just going to do an overview of. If there were interest, it would be 2 or 3 or 4 talks to even cover them in general. But by and large, cognitive biases are grouped as biases of probability and belief, which are sometimes considered as those coming from dealing with too much information. And a classic is the anecdotal fallacy. It can also be a logical error of going by anecdote. It's, you know, particularly when information is just coming out about the possible dangers of cigarette smoking, someone might say, well, you know, my boy Harry smoked cigarettes and he lived to 100, so there can't really be anything wrong with cigarettes. Well, that's an anecdote, but it doesn't really prove the point. But it's the sort of thing we do when we're trying to deal with too much information coming in and the difficulty of sorting information. So the second type of cognitive biases are classified as decision-making and behavioral biases. And they're functionally chalked up to our dealing with not enough meaning. And it's one of the interesting things about human beings, particularly when it comes to bigger issues like spirituality. This is in the name of the famous book, Man's Search for Meaning, is we search for meaning, and we're essentially wired to search for meaning. and an example of that is it's sometimes also categorized as confirmation bias. It is our tendency to seek out or at least adopt things that confirm existing beliefs. The third category is social biases, and those are classified functionally as things that came from the need to act fast. And the sunk cost fallacy is considered one of those. It's in, because also in a situation where you have to make a quick decision, you go with what you know. You do the thing that you've always done. That's yet another example of sunk costs. And the final category is a little bit more esoteric one. It's referred to as memory errors, or sometimes functionally, what should we remember? And mostly that actually explains how the sort of functional cognitive biases that we deal with arise. For example, it describes the errors of thought and perception that result in the forming of stereotypes and prejudices. So I'm going to talk about the two most common groups. You know, if you were to look around or run into some information about cognitive biases, you might run into a list that was something like, you know, 20 things that screw up your business decision making, or 22 things that screw you up in your life. And those would be lists of cognitive bias that came almost exclusively from the first two groups. And those first two groups, one is sometimes classified as dealing with information, the too much information, as we said. And a couple of examples of that, the most common ones, the ones that shows up on those lists you most find, I think some of the most useful ones you consider, are anchoring, which is how we deal with a situation in which something has changed. And in that, people are over-reliant on the first piece of information that they hear, and the first thing that we judge influences our judgment of everything that follows. And you know, we see that in the news, for instance. If a piece of news comes out and there's a report of something, that sticks in people's minds. And if a report comes out the next day that says, oh, you know, that was wrong, that does not stick in people's minds so much. Often they will remember the first thing that came out. Another common one is referred to as availability bias. And functionally, that has to do with when we notice things that are already primed in memory, in our memory, or repeated often. It's also often described as when people overestimate the importance of information is available to them. Our judgments are influenced by what springs most easily to mind. So related to anchoring, we often go with the first thing that comes to mind. That instinct can be an example of that. Sometimes it's right, but sometimes the first thing that comes to mind, again, in problem solving, can be the way that we've always done things, or in particular something that you just heard about. Another example of that is often given is business transactions. If you go down to the used car dealer and he says, you know, this car is $3,000, but I'll give you $500 off, it's only $2,500, that may sound good, but the fact may be that it's actually only a $2,000 car. Another of the best-known biases is confirmation bias, in which we are drawn to details that confirm our existing beliefs. And that's sort of the definition of a whole subcategory. And that is that we tend to listen only to information that confirms our preconceptions and favor things that confirm or fit with our existing beliefs. And I assume that we've probably all seen that at work. Another of the cognitive biases that I'm not going to mention, but that gets relevant here, is it turns out it's easier to see things in others than it is to see them in ourselves. So it's easy to see, I think, when others have fallen to confirmation bias. But that's something we have to check in ourselves, and that's a lot of the issue that goes on today with the trying to have conversations about hot button topics is that we can be very stuck in the confirmation bias of what we already believe, and seeing information only in the light and only fitting with what we already believe, rather than considering it fully. Another one that's often at work is the placebo effect. They sometimes say that that has to do in general with how we fill in characteristics from stereotypes, generalities, and private histories. It's not just how we know it best, perhaps, in terms of medical and health and physical effects, but also in general when simply believing that something will have a certain impact on us that causes it to have that effect. Obviously, in some medicines, you know, you can give people sugar pills and it will have a significant amount of the effect of actual medication. And that goes on, again, sort of like confirmation bias in many other ways as well. So I want to get back to the bigger picture that really interests me. Something in a way I think is almost not dealt with in terms of cognitive biases, but in some way the most grand thing that almost transcends the category and that I've dealt with as being a Unitarian Universalist, and particularly when I was in a church in Denver and led a small group, ministry group. And we had that church in the recent past had had a history of being a strong, almost militantly rationalist, humanist congregation. It was hard to even talk to about issues of spirituality sometimes without suspicion that was just leading back down the road to some sort of traditional dogmatic theological religion. But what I began to realize and really think about, and even in that group, is that we have this innate sense that when we come together, something bigger than us is formed. And while that's sort of like a cognitive bias, it's instinctual to us, it is absolutely a truth that when we come together, we're greater than the sum of the parts. You know, you can see that in a small mundane effort, like building something, but in any greater human effort as well, whether it's a small community or a large one the size of a nation, that we are, in fact, something different when we're all together and something greater. So I'm going to try and get in the New Year's resolution science real quick here for you. If you look at any good sort of evidence and research-based lists of the things that will help you with your New Year's resolutions, and which I would argue in some way are sort of giving you advice on fighting the kinds of cognitive biases and inherent behavior that can sabotage your religions, there are usually three main points. And I'm going to start out with the first one, which I'm going to tie into another great quote from Horace Mann. Which is that habit is a cable. We weave a thread of it every day, and at last we cannot break it. The points get put in different orders, so I'm not going to number them. But a general one is the idea that your consciousness needs to change before your behavior can change, or that you need to change your habits and self-stories. So more important than just, or the important part of making a resolution work is not merely making it and expecting that somehow you'll have the willpower this year to carry it out, but to figure out how to change your habits and, if necessary, to change your self-stories about what you can or cannot do, you know, what you can or cannot succeed at. The second one is essentially small steps to break things down into little pieces, rather than saying, you know, dying thing, I'm going to lose weight this year, start out by saying, you know, I'm going to cut back on 100 calories this week, or, you know, I'm going to switch to putting some sweetener other than sugar in my coffee or tea. And the final one is having some sort of accountability or reinforcement structure to help you sustain the change. The simplest one that's suggested is just to set up something to say that, you know, if you go for a walk and get your exercise in, that when you come back, then you'll get to do something that you want to do. But we respond to reward, and imagining that we're just going to be tough with ourselves and we'll make ourselves do that walk does not comport with human nature for most of us, all but a few, the most determined. So it really helps to have that reward piece put in and to help build the habit. And the other piece about accountability is that if you're trying to build a new habit, it can also help to do it along with others, to agree with someone at the gym, for instance. Which, to me, gets back to that big point that often, as much, particularly in our cultures, we like to imagine ourselves as individualists, we're actually at our best when we're with others and are able to do things that we couldn't do on our own, and that two people together are able to do more than two people individually could. So for closing words, I'm going to start with a little bit of wisdom through the ages. So I found a bunch of nice short quotes that I'll kind of get to the subject. So the ancient philosopher Zeno said, "The most necessary part of learning is unlearning our errors." The Roman philosopher Seneca said, "The mind is slow in unlearning what has just been long in learning." Mark Twain said, "Education consists mainly in what we have unlearned." And finally, on a somewhat lighter note, our Reverend Unitarian and famous educational reformer Horace Mann said, "Do not think of knocking out another person's brains because he differs in opinion from you. It would be as rational to knock yourself on the head because you differ from yourself 10 years ago." And I think we've got maybe a brief time for questions and comments if anyone's interested.
Very good, and I repeat my analogy of Unitarianism, because a lot of the value system is